Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. A new exhibit opened at Gilcrease this weekend, which features images as large as the landscapes they depict. Gus Foster is a well-known Western landscape photographer who's pioneered techniques in panoramic photography. Panoramic Landscapes of the American West is currently on display at Gilcrease, and it features a diversity of Western landscapes in color photographs that are 8, 10, even 12 feet in length. Foster pioneered techniques in creating these incredible views of the West using a panoramic globus hallway scanning camera and custom-made 5-inch roll film to create a 5x25 color negative. In the exhibit, you'll see images from the top of 14,000-foot mountains of the Rocky and Sierra Nevada Mountains to deserts in California and Utah. There are landscapes from 5 national parks, Glacier in Montana, Yellowstone in Wyoming, Canyonlands in Utah, White Sands in New Mexico, and Joshua Tree in California. His work has been shown at the Denver Museum of Art, the Minneapolis Institute of Art, the Huntington Library in Los Angeles, the Buffalo Bill Historical Center in Cody, and the European Center for American Photography in Prague in the Czech Republic. Panoramic Landscapes of the American West, featuring the photography of Gus Foster, continues on display at Gilcrease through October 15th. He joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Gus Foster, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
These panoramic images of the American West involve an amazing, I guess, your own invention of technology of being able to capture these panoramic photographs. But what got you interested in doing these panoramas in the first place?
My first outing as an artist was to make movies about the passage of time.
So you're doing time-lapse photography.
The sense of, I made movies that were, this is about the same time that Andy Warhol was working. But unlike doing the Empire State Building for 24 hours, I'd get in a car and drive 60 miles in 60 minutes. And essentially the view that the passenger would have in an automobile looking out the window, here's this undulating landscape that goes, basically it's a 60-mile-long panorama.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, particularly in the West, where you have
right,
where distant mountains, you see this very subtle...
Very subtle gradation because you have wide vistas for the most part.
But that camera was always pointed at 90 degrees to the direction of travel.
Mm-hmm.
So you had this undulating landscape at the horizon line. And I found that fascinating. So these, even though they were movies and you only saw them at sound speed on a movie screen, the sense of this moving line was captivating to me. And when I moved to New Mexico from Los Angeles, obviously I lost the capacity to easily make movies, and I found a camera that recorded, you know, this wide view, and it clicked to me as being a more reasonable to do, but it encapsulated this idea of the horizon line.
Now, I read a critique of your work, and it was talking about Einstein's story about the reality and time being different for somebody on a streetcar as opposed to a person watching a streetcar. Now, was there any truth to that? Was that at the basis, too?
That was the basis. In before we went on air, we were talking about this little handheld panoramic camera that did multiple panoramas.
Uh-huh.
And those were very much about the passage of time. And in fact, I call that work time photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that led me to back to Einstein's theories, and I'm a layperson, not a scientist, but the idea, the perception of time, in that case, whether you were on the streetcar or on the sidewalk, both looking at the clock, you had a different sense of time.
Yeah, sounds like time has been in the essence of your work from the very start. You know, I mean, whether it's riding in a car, and you know, snapping a picture every mile or every 60 seconds, or, you know, I mean, this idea of watching the landscape through time as opposed to capturing a moment, an instant in time, has appealed to you.
And the time, there is a time element. I don't want to belabor it, but to a photographer, a conventional still photographer, a hundredth of a second is a lot of time.
Yeah.
These panoramic cameras, particularly the quick one, records 2.5 seconds of elapsed real time in one of those long images. They're 12 feet long. They're only about 8 inches high. But it's like a frozen movie, and you will see a motion or an object perhaps as many as 4 times in the space of 2.5 seconds. So it really tells a very abbreviated short story. And the best example I can think of is stuck the car out of a moving vehicle. I mean, again, not film, not movie capture, but rotating camera out the driver's window. And I happened to be in Nebraska, and I spotted a Model A Ford driving down the road. And I was thinking about Antiques Roadshow, one of my favorite programs. And I caught this early Model A four different times as my car approached it and then passed it. And so there it is. It's all, so it's like a 12-foot-long frozen movie.
Yeah. Well, I guess from that idea of capturing time, you started getting onto this idea of the panoramic camera. Now, it sounds like you created all your own equipment for the most part.
The only thing I really created was I designed and built my own enlarger, and then I built a custom color darkroom. The invention of the camera was somebody else. In fact, the Kodak patented the first panoramic camera in 1902, which is what I began with. I had a 1902 circuit camera. And there are a couple of, in the galleries at the Gilcrease, there are a couple of early panoramas of a Wild West show. They didn't put it up just because I'm there, but
You came up with your own sort of devices, though, haven't you?
Well, the camera that I used to make the works in this current exhibition was invented essentially for me in 1985. There were two co-inventors. They each had one, and I was the sucker that came along and paid them some money. But I have the third one. Of course, it was designed as a studio camera. It was never intended to go west of the Hudson River.
Ah.
And I've taken it to this obscure parts of the planet.
Now, is this the small 35 millimeter?
No, this is the big one.
This is the big one. This is the big one that makes a 5x25 color negative.
Yep.
Wow. And this sounds like it's a big piece of equipment, too.
A big piece of equipment. It weighs 65 pounds, and it began life as a studio camera, but obviously modified extensively, almost beyond recognition by the inventors. And, of course, the difference between the 1902 circuit camera, which in those days you'd make a contact print. That's what I did, too. I had an 8-foot tray, 8-foot piece of glass, and I could make 6-foot black and white contact prints. The optics weren't good enough, though, that you could make enlargements. So you got a contact print. That was the wallet size. That was the enlargement. That was everything.
Right.
The quality of the lens has changed so much in the intervening 80 years that I can now take that 25-inch wide negative and make a print that's 16 feet wide.
Wow.
And have it be as clear as, standard.
Now, when you're shooting panoramas, they're not necessarily 360-degree panoramas. Are they just 360 degrees?
Or more.
Yeah, I was going to say, sometimes they're more.
And usually I don't decide in advance that I'm going to make a 400-degree panorama. I just find a subject and compose it, and then I repeat something on both ends. The first picture in the exhibition is of an aspen tree and full bloom in the fall.
Yeah, yellow color.
So you see this picture is bracketed by this golden aspen leaves on both ends. And the reason I started doing that is that commercial photographers would often take an 8x10 negative and cut it in half to give you the appearance of the panoramic format. But if you repeat something in the image, the only way you can get there is to have it go around and do it again. So the conceptual part of it was that, when you're a small format photographer, you can point it this way or that way, and you always have to compose it. By being inclusive of more than 360 degrees, I never left anything out.
Yeah. So it's really a complete picture of that experience at that particular time, but we're not talking about a brief millisecond. We're talking what?
The big camera takes about 30 seconds to go around.
30 seconds.
And so it is not... it's not your Instamatic anymore. It's a complex piece of technical equipment that takes a long time to set up. And, if you or your listeners think back to the kind of equipment that Ansel Adams carried around, this is the same thing, but it's just more high tech.
Right.
And just as cumbersome.
Yeah. You have a big, huge tripod.
A 15-pound Gitzo tripod and a 50-pound camera.
And you've taken that now to at least a number of national parks, from Glacier, Yellowstone, Canyonlands in Utah, White Sands. when you're shooting, I mean, you mentioned Ansel Adams. This is a lot of his country as well as other great photographers. Well, you're doing something different.
I'm doing something different.
But I would think you're looking for something, an image that's a little different as well, aren't you? I mean, I've seen your maroon bells in the Maroon Bells Wilderness. It's not the traditional, you know, the pond scene where you have the pond and the maroon bells in the background. You're finding a very different look.
The difference there is I climbed 14,000-foot mountain to get there. and again, conceptually, that to me was the ultimate panorama because you could see to infinity from any point on the compass.
Right.
And an unobstructed view that literally could encompass 100 miles or more. So if you do the math, that's like a 30,000-square-mile landscape. And I'm not just saying it's not the view out the airplane window. This is stuff. Well, this is that mountain, and that's that city, or this is that plain, that's that river. It's all identifiable, but it's on a single piece of film. I mean, I don't say that I'm not boasting, and I'm not gloating about that. I'm not impressed by the number itself, but it is a big piece of landscape.
Yeah.
And it was that reason when I got the camera from the inventor originally, I'd made the commitment to make landscapes commensurate in size to the this vast area.
It's really the ultimate. It's the ultimate human experience. If you climb to the top of a 14,000-foot mountain, as you turn around, you have this vast landscape in front of you. But there's usually no way really to capture that. And this is probably gets closer than most because you have that sense of movement in a panoramic photograph.
And you don't have to be on top of the mountain. Some of the earliest work I did was in western Oklahoma in the old geographical center of the Dust Bowl, which is now mostly wheat.
Yeah.
It probably would have been wheat then if they'd had irrigation. But this sense of extremely simple landscape that, you know, no trees, just wheat fields in the foreground and infinite skies in the horizon.
And of course,
it's a big space.
And it's also a very interesting space when you actually stop to look at it too, because what seems at first glance flat and featureless, when you really stare at it, you see all sorts of features.
Yeah, it undulates.
It undulates. It moves.
You can see the pattern going through the grasses. I mean, I've done the same equivalent things in the panhandle of Texas where new wheat crop just coming out of the ground, 4-inch shoots.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of amber and blue, it's
green.
Emerald green and blue skies or gray.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, I jokingly say that those minimal works like that are about as close as I'm ever going to get to Ellsworth Kelly.
The color field painter. Yeah.
Minimalist painter.
Yeah. My guest today is Gus Foster, photographer. Gilcrease Museum is presenting an exhibition of his work titled Panoramic Landscapes of the American West, photographs by Gus Foster, on display through October 15th at the museum. And they feature these huge panoramic Western landscapes that are 8, 10, 12 feet in length. He's pioneered these techniques of using panoramic cameras. And we've talked about the big one that takes 30 seconds to go around. You have another smaller one that is handheld that goes around what?
It'll make a circle in 8/10 of a second.
8/10 of a second. I've seen some of your work on your website. Like there's a great shot at the Michigan Stadium where at the football game, and it probably goes around what, 2-3 times?
Yes, three full panoramas, so 1,080.
We see a cheerleader in the distance. He comes right through the middle of the frame and then out to one side.
I'd had a show in Michigan, and the athletic director invited me to take a picture from the center of the 50-yard line during the halftime. At that point in history, Michigan Stadium was the world's largest group.
Yeah, right. It was 105, 108,000 people.
Uh-huh. So I had the world's largest group portrait. And I had less than 60 seconds. Of course, Big Ten sports is highly organized. And, you know, they've got halftime shows and lots of commercials and this and that. And the guy said, you've got a total of 60 seconds to get the camera out, get it set up, shoot it, and get off the field. And if you don't do that, I'm going to run you over. And this was with the 1902 camera.
Oh.
So it was. So we pre-focused it, and a friend of mine and I were racing out like the water boys as soon as the half started, shot this picture. and went racing off again. I had one chance to do it.
Right.
So during the hemp, because I had a, what do you call it, a pit pass or something, uh-huh. special deal, they let me hang out with the cheerleaders in the corner for the rest of the game. And when Michigan scores a touchdown, the cheerleaders, the picture that you uh-huh. saw on the website is this cheerleader jumping through the legs of all the other cheerleaders, and they do it one for every point. And so here the guy's doing airborne and somersaults and land on the ground, and the other one does it. And that was a big scoring game, so I don't know. There were 21 repetitions.
Yeah.
But just the sheer acrobatic of it appealed to me.
And that was probably a much better picture than the one in the middle of the field.
Yes, I'm much happier with that than the group portrait.
Yeah.
But that ended up in the president's office, and I'm told it's still there.
Oh, good. Of the pieces in the show, you're working in probably, what, about 5, 6, 7 states. What are you looking for when you're looking for a place to capture a panorama? You mentioned climbing to a top of a 14,000-foot mountain, but not all of those are those particular.
No, there are only a handful of those in the show. But I've in fact done about 100 summits.
Yeah.
I did a project, took me 15 years to complete. Essentially, it was a panoramic portrait of the American Rockies, and I started, the Rockies begin or end in southern New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in fact, go all the way just short of Alaska. But my range was to stop at the Canadian border in Montana. So I did 100 summits between southern New Mexico and the Canadian border in Montana. And it was sort of like, if you think of the kids' game of Connect the Dots,
mm-hmm.
I'd climb one mountain if I could see another one.
That would be the next one.
I'd go climb that. And then, so that would give me two reference points to either, on a clear day, you could see either of them.
Uh-huh.
And I just kept going back and forth.
That is an approach I've seen in a lot of your work, that sort of didactic sort of approach of, I want to connect the dots. Mm-hmm. You've done two cross-country walks, which actually make the form of an X, mm-hmm. one from Juarez to Sault Ste. Marie, and then the other from roughly the Canadian border above Juarez down right. to the Gulf Coast.
I walked directly, until I ran out of land.
Yeah, basically making a big giant X.
And that is I laugh at myself because it was started as a really bad pun of giving new definitions to the phrase cross country.
Uh-huh.
Particular pun took 9 months.
Yeah,
Over 2 years to bring to realization. But about 20 years prior to that, I'd walked across a section of Japan, and I learned something that, I've been a landscape photographer my whole adult career, but I learned that you see the world differently at 2 miles an hour than you do at 60. You're the same person, same eyes, but changing that, the speed and the scale of the experience, it was very informative.
Well, it's an utterly different form of photography, I think. I think it's very much more human-paced, I think, than, you're dealing with larger-than-life subjects when you're doing all these panoramic photographs, but when you're walking, it's very much human,
yeah,
sort of
sense
a
of
human,
time.
Human sense of time, and also a human sort of experience, if you will.
And the further thing in it, and what really appealed to me is in an earlier life, I had worked in a museum, and my introduction to Japanese art was the work of Ando Hiroshige, who did this project called the Tokaido Road back in the 1830s. Of course, in the 1830s, people rarely traveled more than 30 miles from the village they were born in.
Yeah, you never left your home.
You didn't, and it wasn't until the westward expansion that was equally true in this country. But Hiroshige was the son of a minor samurai. And so is he, because he had some connection to power, he got to go in one of these large retinues, and the shogun might have had 20,000 guys going by foot from Tokyo to Kyoto. It was about 300 miles. But it's not 300 miles like you and I think about 300 miles today. I mean, this was probably 40 rivers to ford, and there are no bridges, and there are no boats. And so somebody carried the equipment, carried the pelicans across the rivers. It was a real ordeal.
Yeah.
And Hiroshige made these fabulous series of woodcuts that are probably as well known in many parts of the world as Picasso would be. And the museum I worked in happened to have a complete set of these, and they just opened my mind to enormous possibilities. And essentially, he was the first traveler because he recorded these
great
travelogues.
The first travelogue, yeah.
First travelogue.
Well, you know,
And again, that appealed. That brought it to mind to me. Of course, I didn't speak Japanese, and I was completely self-contained. I had 100 rolls of film and this little panoramic camera and a bivy sack to keep dry and a couple days' worth of clothing. And even my maps were in Japanese kanji. And I had a hell of a time. After I left Tokyo, I never even saw an English sign.
Yeah, right.
And so it was an ordeal. But I've spent a lot of time in the wilderness. This was just in the wilderness surrounded by 250 million people.
Well, I tell you, that first section of that Fuore is going north, that's some desolate country out there.
Yeah. There were a lot of pit bulls down by the border.
Well, you know, the other thing that's interesting is when you look at the things that you put on the website, a lot of police officers and sheriffs. Now, I would like to hope that they were checking on you.
Yeah, they were checking. Well,
but it was also like, you know, who are you and what are you doing out here?
The very first time I got stopped was near Tucumcari, New Mexico. And somebody had called in and said, there's this crazy man walking on the wrong side of the highway. I wasn't on the wrong side. I always walked facing traffic.
Facing traffic, right. That's the right way.
But I had, you know, walking sticks, and somebody reported me, and so they sent out a local car to see who this insane person was. They got part of it right. But the guy ended up, you know, I took his picture.
Uh-huh.
It was just because it was the first time I'd been stopped.
I gathered that became the tradition.
It was.
Yeah, anytime that happens, you know, every state probably.
Almost everyone. It was not the kind of a cross-country venture where I was trying to raise money, you know, so you were seeking publicity. I just was out. I was walking.
That made you even weirder.
And if people engaged me, I was more than happy to talk to them.
Right.
But I didn't, you know, I wasn't calling ahead to the paper or the radio station or whatever to get publicity for my cause, because there was no cause. I was just doing this work.
And you got a lot of great pictures out of this. I mean, there was, you know, just walking by something and seeing it, and you see it for a while, and you say, wow, that's going to be a good picture, and it probably turned out most of the time to be.
Yes, but those were all snapshots. I didn't do any panoramas on that trip. It was more panoramic by the nature of the whole project.
I love the image of you're on a highway that's under construction. They have one of those little solar-powered sign is like speed limit's 55, and you're going 5.
But I was, in fact, it said I was going 5, but I was only going 3. And so I wanted, you know, I didn't get a ticket. And I was ready to plead my cause in front of a municipal judge. But it struck my funny bone as being able to, you know, you'd have to be running to go 5 miles an hour.
That's true. Yeah.
So I knew I was in the right.
Yeah. Well, I hope a lot of people come out to Gilcrease to see these panoramic landscapes of the American West. Top of mountains, the bottom of canyons. What was probably the harshest condition you lugged this 65-pound camera to as far as a shot that you're very proud of?
Well, there are a lot of tough ones. In this exhibition, there's one on the top of Mount Whitney in California.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Prior to our acquisition of Alaska, it was the tallest mountain in the lower 48. And it's the highest point in California as well, and so it's enormously popular. I didn't want to climb it and have 60 of my fellow Americans hovering around while I did it. So I chose to do essentially a winter climb.
Wow.
And so it was 2 ice axes and crampons and same 65-pound camera. It took me a couple days to drive there, and then I left the trailhead and a day to climb to a base camp. And then the summit day, we went up a ice field, and once I got to the ridge, about maybe 3 miles from the summit, started snowing.
Mm.
And I got caught in this hellacious blizzard on the top of the mountain. But when I got to the summit, I was madder than hell. I was just fit to be tied because you couldn't see 50 yards. I'd driven halfway across the country to get this thing, and I was so mad. I said, I'm not going home empty-handed. And I set up the camera and took the shutter and in the middle of the snowstorm. Came back, looked at the negative, it was like a Zen. It was a perfect Zen negative. It was better than anything I could have gotten on a nice day. But it proved to me that even when you know what you're looking at, you don't know a thing. And so I ended up with this really, and because it's a storm, this mountain, which is the highest place in the United States, could also be the middle of the coast of Maine in a winter storm.
Yeah.
It's beyond place.
You know, we think of the eye being far more sensitive than the camera lens, but a lot of times the camera lens sees things that our brain filters out. It sees the things that our brain just says, that can't be right, I'm going to fix it. Our brain is a great editor, isn't it?
It is. Well, and there's another mountain that this picture is also in the exhibition. I climbed atop of a 14,000-foot mountain in Colorado called Windham Peak. And the summit is smaller than the space between you and I, maybe less than 4 feet.
Wow.
And the tripod takes up that much room. So I set up the camera. It's 2,000 feet down on one side, 3,000 feet down on the other. The cloud cover is virtually at eye level. I started the shutter, climbed down under the camera, counted off on my watch enough time to make sure it went around. Clicked it off, dismantled it, hurried down because lightning is a big problem when you're that high and with
sure.
that much metal. So I went home and processed the negative, and right, lo and behold, in the middle of this cloud cover, there's a perfect circle looking to infinity right in the middle of the composition. And of course, dumb luck, I had no idea that there was going to be anything there, let alone this one shot to infinity, in a 6 foot or an 8 foot print, there's maybe 5 inches of open view of the horizon, and everything else is cloud cover.
Wow.
And these enormous rocks.
Right. Wow. Oh, well, it sounds like that's as good a reason to go out to Gilcrease as any, just to see that.
Well, it's one of my favorite. Of course, people ask, what's your favorite thing? And in case, if it's a collector, it's the one you're considering. right that moment. Or, Bob Pickering curated this show, and boy, I agree with his 21 choices perfectly.
All right. Well, Panoramic Landscapes of the American West continues on display through October 15th. Gus, it was a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Western landscape photographer Gus Foster speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Panoramic Landscapes of the American West, photographs by Gus Foster, opened over the weekend at Gilcrease Museum and continues on display there through October 15th. More information at gilcrease.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent broadcasts, you can listen anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa, and you can search some of our past programs as well. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.